In Phoenix, where Thursday's 115 was 3 degrees short of a record, they were trying to make the best of it. Vegas, they're expecting another scorcher today, 112 degrees, as the West bakes in a record-breaking heat wave. The pressure's high, just to stay alive, 'cause the heat is on.
You may take a summer vacation, but human damage to the planet never does. In fact, this has been an amazing summer all over the world. Today we'll explore the crazy flash floods that dumped months' worth of rain on Britain in just a few hours. The hardest rains since records began in the 1700s flooded Sheffield in northern England, and then a month later burst through Gloucestershire and Wales, taking out power stations, water supplies, and thousands of homes. Even London got a dosing with the new climate phenomenon, extreme rainfall. Also in this show, Canadian scientists confirm for the first time that we don't just get global warming, but global wetting in some parts of the world. No big surprise for Vancouver residents in Washington State after last winter set records for dismal weather. But people in Newfoundland were shocked by their summer tropical storm last week, and half of Bangladesh is underwater. The wets get wetter, but the dries get drought. We'll hear from Dr. Jonathan Overpeck of the University of Arizona as he describes the start of the long drought, hitting not just the American Southwest, but possibly the whole prairies of Canada and the United States. Then we'll hear a personal letter from a woman in Serbia, which is all but up in flames during the recent heat wave that struck the Mediterranean and especially Eastern Europe. Hundreds of forest fires and all-time record highs up to 45 degrees centigrade, 113 degrees in the shade. Romania shut down as dozens died of the heat. Finally, we follow discoveries that the pine bark beetle plague in Canada's west, caused by climate change, may bring even more greenhouse gases when it's logged. Just another positive feedback effect humans never expected. It's a global report. The planet's systems are going wonky even while we are on vacation. I'm your host, Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Britain has become the latest victim of weird weather attributed to climate change. The rains and flooding there have been so strange, they defy all human memory. There hasn't been anything like it since detailed weather record keeping began in 1766. In late June, up to 4 inches of rain fell almost overnight in parts of northern England. The city of Sheffield was hard hit as the downtown went underwater. Smaller towns and villages all around found water coming in over the windowsills. Cars disappeared underwater. Insurance costs from just the June rains was estimated at over $4 billion, with plenty more rain to come. This is the new phenomenon of hard rain, which I covered in my EcoShock show of June 8, 2007. You can download that show, Hard Rain Gonna Fall, from our website at ecoshock.org. Britain has been so shocked by this phenomenon of torrential rain that the government there has been calling for new studies. Already, scientists have found this is not normal weather, but a new type of rainfall for the British Isles.
We certainly think that climate change will mean this sort of event could become more frequent. The problem with these events is that they are very extreme and they are very unpredictable in terms of both their location and how violent they're going to be.
That's Baroness Barbara Young from the UK's Environment Protection Agency.
The government, academics, the press, and the general public all accept these new instant floods are caused by human-induced climate change. The new Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, has promised an extra $500 million to fight off climate change. People outside Britain haven't really got the picture. These rains have stretched over an entire month, hitting various parts of the country rapid fire with rainfall that completely overwhelms not just the rivers, but drainage systems that have served to protect the country over several centuries. After the Sheffield floods of late June, rivers burst their banks further south in Wales, and especially in Gloucestershire. In late July, the town of Gloucester went underwater. Over 4,500 homes were flooded out. 3 months' worth of rain fell in just 4 hours. That's hard to imagine, isn't it? Rainy Britain, 3 months' worth in 4 hours. Over 50,000 homes in Hertfordshire went without electricity after a power station was flooded. Strangely, as homes, businesses, and hospitals went underwater, a huge shortage of drinkable water developed. The water plants also had to be shut down. Britain went into a near wartime system of portable water stations called bowsers, occasionally filled up by water trucks. Out to the nearest plastic water tank with your pots and pans to take back home. Hundreds of thousands of people were without safe water for days, still don't have clean water in their taps over 2 weeks later. YouTube was also flooded with home video taken of cars floating by people's homes, roads disappearing under brand new lakes, old people being rescued by helicopters. There were several deaths. The Army, Navy, and Air Force were called in to help. Even London was hit by a hard rain that filled the underpasses, some housing, and the tube. All over England, classic buildings, many centuries old, were flooded for the first time. If you think climate change is just going to hit the third world, get on YouTube and type in UK floods. You'll be amazed at what you see. At the same time, Bangladesh is half underwater as the monsoon hits extra heavy, but we don't see much video from there. We don't even have to leave Canada to find strange vicious rain. Tropical storm Chantal knocked eastern Newfoundland off its feet last week with a quick burst of unbelievably hard rain, followed by sunshine the next day. Old homes were washed off their foundations. New rivers appeared. Drainage systems completely failed. Again, it's the new phenomenon of climate change, hard rain. Why does this happen? The simple fact is that a hotter atmosphere sucks up more water. The air becomes loaded with moisture. Warmer seas also kick up more water into the air. All this has to come down somewhere, and we think that air pollution particles may cause water droplets to condense into larger raindrops. Then, when conditions are right, the whole soggy mass comes down suddenly, more than anyone has seen in record-breaking rains. You have likely seen it where you live. And weather experts and climate scientists say this is the new future. Sudden rains with record amounts overwhelming the natural drainage systems provided by creeks and rivers, not to mention the aging stormwater systems in most cities. Keep your ears and eyes out for this kind of news, because a hard rain is already falling in many parts of the world. Here is a radio montage of Britain under siege from an unstable climate.
The worst is not over for many. The waters continue to rise in some areas. Just a few miles from here near Rotherham, engineers are in a race against time to stop the dam wall at the Ully Reservoir from bursting and flooding the surrounding area. Well, the rainfall here in Sheffield yesterday was absolutely unprecedented. The city had never seen anything quite like it. So much rain in such a short space of time. And it turned rivers like this, like the Don, into the raging torrent that you can see here, causing so much damage. Not just Sheffield, but other areas of South Yorkshire.
These people are among the lucky ones who've been rescued from floodwaters that have covered large parts of southwest and central England. A massive emergency operation is now underway to get clean water to millions of others who've been left stranded. The Army and Royal Air Force are said to be distributing up to 5 million bottles of water a day until tap supplies are restored. But as that may not happen for another 2 weeks, tensions are rising in some of the worst hit areas.
It's a hassle without running water, and like obviously no drinking water either, which, I mean, on the radio they keep saying, oh, they're giving out bottled water, but we can't get the bottled water.
Despite warnings about contaminated water, many people are having fun with the floods. Although water levels have receded in some of the worst hit areas thanks to pumping efforts, forecasters say they expect more showers across England throughout the week, with heavy rainfall predicted for Thursday.
Overseas again now, and in England and Wales, tens of thousands of people are preparing for another flood emergency after a weekend of storms and torrential rain. More than 100 people were airlifted to safety after being trapped by rising flood water, and thousands more were rescued by emergency services workers and the military. But the disaster has put pressure on the British government to explain its delay in acting, and there are calls for an urgent review of the UK's drainage infrastructure. In London, Stephanie Kennedy reports.
Britain's summer has so far failed to materialise, and there was no better evidence than the weekend of dark clouds and flash flooding. It was a cascading torrent in many villages and towns, as rivers broke their banks and water flooded through the streets and lanes. As residents emerged, they found themselves waist-deep in water. In some areas, a month's rainfall fell in just 2 hours. With local services overwhelmed, the armed forces were called in to help with the rescue effort. Shirley Stard runs the Northwick Hotel on the banks of the River Avon in the town of Evesham. 30 of her guests have been evacuated.
The whole of the ground floor is absolutely a write-off. It almost went up to the ceilings. You know, the whole place is a write-off on the ground floor.
With water treatment plants overwhelmed by the flooding water, there are now fears 350,000 people could lose their water supply. The Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, has moved to reassure people the government is doing all it can.
We've got the armed forces working with the civilian services to make possible this rescue effort and to make sure that people are as safe as possible. I think, however, we've got to learn lessons for the future about how we provide to deal with an emergency such as this. We've got to look at what we're doing in terms of infrastructure, in terms of drainage.
In the 21st century, the UK relies on a water drainage and pipe system that was built in the Victorian era. And according to Baroness Barbara Young, head of the Environment Protection Agency, billions of dollars needs to be spent updating the out-of-date system.
We certainly think that climate change will mean this sort of event could become more frequent. The problem with these events is that they are very extreme and they are very unpredictable in terms of both the location and how violent they're going to be.
That's Baroness Barbara Young from the UK's Environment Protection Agency, ending that report from Stephanie Kennedy.
Overnight, police played a waiting game. Thousands of tons of water appeared ready to burst in. No one knew when or with what result. And Gloucester became the city that didn't sleep. This morning, thousands of houses already without water lost their electricity. A power station flooded, had to be switched off. And so a double blow for residents. A cup of tea or a wash meant collecting water from communal tanks on the street.
Yes, people around here have been telling me they've been seeing the devastation around the country, and they thought this time the floods were really going to miss them. But the heavens opened earlier today, and this is the result. This is the centre of Purley. This is the main pathway through the town centre, and it's worse, the water came up as high as 14 feet. Well, locals tell me it's never flooded in this part before. Matthew Morris has been taking a look at some of the other pictures that have been coming in to our newsrooms, on our cameras, across London and the South East.
Torrential rain and thunderstorms, the great British summer. Across London, the roads began to look like rivers. As the water levels rose, cars had to be abandoned. BBC London viewers have been sending in their pictures as the severe weather brought many parts of the capital to a standstill.
So how do we know this crazy rainfall is part of climate change? Aside from the British studies by the Hadley Centre and others, two Canadian scientists are publishing a study in the journal Nature this month. They compare rainfall records over the past 75 years from around the world to the predictions from 14 different computer climate models. According to Randy Boswell of the CanWest News Service, quote, the researchers concluded that at least 50% and as much as 85% of average rainfall increases at northern latitudes between 1925 and 1999 could be attributed to human activities. End quote. Average annual precipitation went up by 62 millimeters over the last century. Not much good news for soggy Vancouverites, who just went through the darkest, wettest winter anyone can remember. The snowpack in the mountains of British Columbia was 150% over normal levels. Environment Canada predicts that, in general, Canada will become wetter, although the central provinces may experience drought in the southern regions. The prairies dry out, while both coasts become wetter than ever. Scientists have developed maps that show that Earth is splitting into rainfall haves and have-nots. While drought strikes the interior of several continents, floods rearrange other parts of the world. In general, the wets get wetter and the dry areas become deserts. Francis Wires, Director of Environment Canada's Climate Research Division, points out that human influence has already been shown in the warming of both the air and the ocean. But we are only now able to prove that humans have changed the pattern of rainfall on Earth. Climate change, for many in the Northern Hemisphere, it's not just global warming, but global wetting. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website at www.ecoshock.org.
The Rock tonight, sopping wet after getting sideswiped by a storm that sucked up millions of liters of water over the Atlantic and wrung itself out big time over Newfoundland. Chantal has come and gone, but not before leaving a mess of washed out roads and flooded homes and businesses. Global National's Ross Lord on storm duty tonight.
Even by Newfoundland standards, this storm was a menace, pelting the province with up to 150 millimeters of rain, almost 2 months' worth, in less than 12 hours. Tropical Storm Chantal saving her fury for Newfoundland and Labrador after missing the Maritimes.
It's unusual here for St. John's to get this sort of tropical rainfall. Now here we are a few hours later with the sun is out. It's highly unusual. We usually tend to get a long, drawn-out rain, not so intense over long periods.
When I come down this morning, the door is open. The water's up to here. Full cellar door.
Back in St. John's, water seeping under streets forced some to buckle, while office buildings pumped out water most of the day, and the famous George Street looked more like Niagara Falls. Ross Lord, Global News.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Coming up next, the record heat wave in Europe.
Well, they're called the dog days of summer, and if you step outside in much of the country, you know why. The kind of sizzling temperatures dogs know to find shade from. Atlantic Canada, the only cool region, as most of us cope with uncomfortably hot sunshine. But there is nowhere hotter than the prairies, where tonight the heat is starting to create some serious issues with healthcare delivery.
Kevin, while it is hot across most of the country today, in Regina it is scorching. The temperature is approaching 38 degrees, and factor in the humidity, it feels a lot hotter than that.
Sure, it's blazing hot in most of Canada. Weather maps show much of the country is above normal for July, as it is in the United States. And while Britain was trying to pump out the floodwater from torrential rains, the Mediterranean was dealing with fires and extended heat alerts. Greece was battling up to 100 forest fires in plus 40 degrees centigrade heat. That's over 140 degrees Fahrenheit. Italy was also blazing with both heat and more forest fires. Hotels burned, and beachgoers had to be rescued in 42 degree heat. The Canary Islands were ablaze. Romanian authorities blamed extreme heat for at least 30 deaths, as Eastern Europe experienced absolute record temperatures. Government buildings were shut down to conserve power, as those with air conditioners blasted them to the max. Temperatures reached 41 degrees centigrade, or 106, for several days in a row. Authorities declared an emergency red alert. In late July, Bulgaria was 45 degrees centigrade, or 113 Fahrenheit, in the shade. That is the hottest since records began to be kept in that country. The government of Serbia reports that 30% of the annual harvest has been killed off by high heat, including wheat, soya, and vegetables, another side effect of climate change. We are less able to feed ourselves. Now we have a personal letter from Serbia, written by Jasmina Tasanovic, the girlfriend of famous science fiction writer Bruce Sterling. He's been living and reporting from Serbia while writing his next novel. Sterling was early predicting extreme climate change with his 1994 novel, Heavy Weather. I got this letter from Jasmina from Bruce's personal mailing list called Viridian Notes. It's titled Serbia and the Flames. I think it reveals a lot about the way people are reacting and will react to climate change. Here goes Serbia and the Flames by Jasmina Tasanovic. Today was the hottest day in Serbia ever since the temperature has been measured, 45 degrees centigrade. If we Serbs were truly interested in our survival as a nation, we'd be scrambling to get some modern hardware for dealing with ecological catastrophes. It's been 10 years since Milosevic sold off our forest-fighting aircraft and pocketed the money. we would talk together seriously about last year's massive floods throughout the Danube Basin, about this year's deadly heat wave in Serbia and throughout the Balkans, about the state of emergency in our neighbor Greece, about the electricity shortages and blackouts throughout the region, about the woods of our homeland set on fire. Even tidy Britain is being overwhelmed with their flood catastrophes, while here in Serbia we lack any organized emergency response, because the Serbian state is, by its nature, in an emergency situation all the time. Instead, the Serbian parliament spent this day discussing Kosovo, angling for Russian friendship to fend off the US demands, while dodging EU pressure to simply let go of that long-lost province. They have no air conditioning inside the Serbian parliament, so delegates were comically fanning themselves with official papers while the presidents were sweating in their stuffy official suits. The Russians promised us practical help for the smoldering forests of the border, but they have yet to send a single Russian helicopter. Meanwhile, the firemen and local peasants are saving our burning forest heritage with raw courage and mostly hand tools. When will we overcome our local obsessions and realize we are part of a world in a general crisis? The climate crisis isn't for rich countries, it's for every country, especially us. We had floods in 2006 and now fires in 2007. The cause is in the air and we will end up with no earth. Global warming is invisible. It steals up on us like a slow fever, but our daily lives are being transformed by it. Kids can't get milk at school, eggs might be poisoned with salmonella, the crops are wilting in the fields. My friend, a pianist, sews clothes by her air conditioner instead of playing her piano. I am singing after dark instead of writing at noon. My friend is writing a book about the future, but is not sure if it is the same book he started anymore. My young friend, the web designer, had her computer collapse, so she went out to walk her three dogs and collapsed from the heat in 2 hours. My friend, activist from the inner Serbia, is sleeping in an office where there is an air conditioner. 2 weeks ago, she condemned air conditioners because they burn fossil fuels and make the global warming worse. She also has the very Serbian superstition that cold drafts of the air are not good for your bones. Well, any hot draft of air over 40 degrees does not cool your body. It heats your body and can kill you from heat stroke. My pregnant Albanian friend from Pristina sleeps heavily day and night while her friends in Kosovo demonstrate some unilateral declaration of independence. If there is any justice in this injustice, it is that global warming has no borders or nationality. And yet it has guilty and victims. Guilty, all of us who ignored inconvenient truths and sacrificed the ecological conscience for other more or less legitimate priorities. Victims, everyone yet to be born on our damaged planet. When crops wilt and forests burn down to black stumps, does it matter if that wasteland is called Kosovo or Serbia? Year by year, mankind is becoming justly afraid of our vengeful climate. I have an epiphany. Our world in 1999 is becoming all the world. No electrical, no water, no business as usual. Fear. I remember those bombing days of Serbia and Kosovo when everyone in this land, without exception, was a refugee under a scowling enemy sky. That was written by Jasmina Tasanovic, a Serbian witness to the extreme heat baking Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean this summer. And I am Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Find us at our website at www.ecoshock.org. Up next, Professor Overpeck explains the threat of drought to the U.S. Southwest, and it's more pressing even than rising oceans.
In Phoenix, where Thursday's 115 was 3 degrees short of a record, they were trying to make the best of it.
Vegas, they're expecting another scorcher today, 112 degrees, as the West bakes in a record-breaking heat wave.
The pressure's high, just to stay alive, because the heat is on.
98 in Boise,
100 degrees in Salt Lake City and Bismarck, and 104 degrees in Rapid City, 20 degrees above the normal temperature for July.
I love the heat. That's why I moved here, for the heat. This is a little extreme, but I love it.
Hey, we all love endless summer. Of course, green turns to brown, leaves to spikes on cacti, rivers to rock beds. That is the future of the American West and parts of Canada as the new climate regime brings out record droughts, the kind that last at least 40 years and maybe centuries. In November 2006, the University of Arizona rounded up their top climate scientists for a series of public speeches. Today, we're going to listen to a few excerpts from Jonathan Overpeck, the director for the study of planet Earth at the university, and a much-published scientist on climate research. He has projects going on in the Arctic, the American Southwest, and South America. Dr. Overpeck began the speech with mind-numbing reports about the speed-up in Arctic ice melt, including the Greenland ice sheet. Scientists expected a slow melt over many centuries, but now predict a rapid rise of sea level. At first, humans will experience this as storm surges. Right now, in August of 2007, almost half of Bangladesh is underwater as monsoon storms drive the sea over the country. New Orleans felt it. These waters recede, but they come more often, stay longer, and eventually just stay. In Florida, in the former paradise of South Pacific Islands, in the major cities of the east coast of both China and the United States. That is what we are leaving our children and their children. But in Arizona and most of the interior of the West, there is a more immediate threat. Drought dries out the land, higher temperatures demand even more from the plant life, and then fires become normal. Let's listen to a few clips from Dr. Jonathan Overpeck in a speech delivered October 24, 2006, and still available on the University of Arizona website, and as a free MP3 download on the climate pages of ecoshock.org.
Okay, now I want to turn to what's happening in the Arctic and what that means for the Earth, because I think it's very significant. I work a lot in the Arctic, and I just, like I said, I'm just blown away, as are my colleagues, about what's happening up. And it's sort of out of sight, out of mind, but it has a lot of implications for those of us in the United States. Basically, the Arctic is warming more than any other place on the planet, as we've already seen, and it's melting, very fast. We've seen in the Arctic sea ice, this is the ice that floats on the North Polar Oceans, several meters thick. This ice, in just the last 50 years, has thinned by 40%. I don't think any scientists anticipated those kinds of numbers. That's huge. The other thing that's happening is every summer, the ice retreats back and gets smaller because it's warm up there, midnight sun, and then in winter it expands out again. Well, every year, every summer, as shown on this graph, since we started having satellite measurements of the entire Arctic ice pack, it retreats further back. The ice pack in summer is getting smaller, and then when it grows in winter, we're actually seeing that it's not growing as large as it used to. So we're starting to see not only the sea ice thin, but we're starting to see it just literally retreat away. But the bigger change, the change that I really worry about, and I spend a lot of my time studying, is the change on the great ice sheet in the northern hemisphere, the Greenland ice sheet. Locked up in this ice sheet are about 23 feet of sea level rise if the whole ice sheet were to melt. And what we've seen in just the period from 1979 to 2002, again, this is the beginning of the satellite record, this whole area that's shown in this light pink color between 79 and 02 started to melt in summer. And then just since 2002 to 2005, that summer melt area has expanded into the area shown in red. So the actual area of the Greenland ice sheet that's melting in summer is accelerating. And it's actually the mass of this ice sheet, the total amount of water locked up in this ice sheet, is starting to shrink in an ever-accelerating fashion. We can measure that in numerous ways. And what's happening when the water melts on the surface in summer, this picture was taken, it was on the cover of Science magazine, is that there are actually crevices and conduits right through several kilometers, over a mile of ice, to the bed of the ice sheet, where that water then flows underneath the ice sheet between the bedrock and the ice. And that actually acts to lubricate the bottom of the ice sheet, and these glaciers that form the ice sheet are flowing out to the ocean faster. So the ice sheet isn't just losing mass by melting, it's losing mass by ice flowing out to the ocean faster, more icebergs. And you can see this in things like earthquakes underneath the ice sheet are rapidly, you know, we're getting more and more earthquakes. So something is happening to this ice sheet, and it doesn't look good. And a number of us scientists and I decided to look into what could this mean for the future. And what we did is we went to the last time we think that the Greenland ice sheet was smaller, a time when we knew that global sea level was up to 21 feet higher than the present day. How do we know that? Because there are coral reefs that grew underwater at that time, 125,000 years ago, that are now about that far above sea level. For example, the Florida Keys. You can drive on those now. 125,000 years ago, they were several feet underwater. And you see these kinds of reefs all over the ocean at low latitudes, and you can date them very easily. Well, we did this study using paleoclimatic observations from ice cores and sediments and things, and we also used the state-of-the-art climate models and ice sheet models to try and reconstruct what the Greenland ice sheet looked like 125,000 years ago compared to today. Here's the big ice sheet, and the brighter the color, the higher the ice sheet. And you can see that in the middle, the ice sheet is almost 3 kilometers thick. And there were parts of the ice sheet back 125,000 years ago that were almost as high, but the ice sheet was much smaller. Southern Greenland, those areas where we have all that melt now, it was toast 125,000 years ago, all around that ice sheet. And what we discovered in our work, using both models and data, so we came at it from two directions and got the same answer, was that 8 degrees of warming in the Arctic was enough to melt back the Greenland ice sheet by up to 12 feet of sea level rise equivalent. Just 8 degrees. And remember I told you to remember that number for 2005? 4 degrees in just the last 30, 40 years? We're halfway there. When we started this work, we were saying, well, this was going to be the kind of warming we'd have by the end of the century. But it looks like Mother Nature has something else in store for us. It's coming a lot faster than we thought. And by the middle of this century, we might be warm enough to melt this ice sheet. But remember I said sea level. We know pretty darn well that it was up to 21 feet higher than present, not just 12 feet like we could get out of Greenland. Where did the rest come from? There are not many places. You have to go south. And you have to go to the Antarctic ice sheet, which is actually two ice sheets, which people lose track of, particularly people who write articles for the media. You have the big East Antarctic ice sheet, which we think might actually grow in the future a little, although there are signs that it won't be that much. And then you have the West Antarctic ice sheet. This part of the ice sheet is actually grounded below sea level for the most part, and there's the Antarctic Peninsula. And many of you have probably seen in the news these big ice shelves the size of Rhode Island and breaking up and flowing out in the ocean. And then the glaciers behind them are flowing out to the ocean even faster. So there's signs that some really big changes going on in the West Antarctic ice sheet, and much of the mass balance or mass of this ice sheet is also declining in an accelerating fashion now. And we think 125,000 years ago, this ice sheet looked like this. And we actually have this work that was done by colleagues published in 1998 where they drilled through the ice sheet. And this work was kind of ignored by the community until we came along and did this new analysis. But they drilled through this thing, and underneath the ice sheet, right in the middle of it, they found evidence, both fossil evidence and geochemical evidence, that indicated that ice sheet had to be, was very likely not there sometime in the last couple hundred thousand years. And we put A plus B together and came up with, this is where the rest of that sea level rise came from. So if you live along the coast of the United States, in the Gulf Coast, East Coast, you really got to worry. Is that the worst that could befall this country? Remember, the sea level rise is going to take centuries, so I really like to think of the sea level rise as going to start in our lifetimes, and certainly the hurricanes are, and their big storm surges up to 20 feet or more with the big hurricanes. It's going to be a problem in this century, but a lot of it's going to be next generational. We're going to put the pollution up there that's going to make this inevitable, but it's going to be our kids and their kids that are going to have to deal with it. Is there something else we should be worried about? And that's what I really want to talk about today. If we decide, on the other hand, just let her rock and roll, this is the inside the beltway strategy, it's going to get toasty. And I'm going to show you how toasty in a second. But just to sort of look ahead, at least 8 degrees warmer. That's like going from a glacial period to an interglacial period. It's big, and it'll have huge impacts, as you'll see in a minute. If you look at what's happening already, this is a map produced by colleagues at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It shows the years of the this century minus the 60s through 80s of the last century. This is kind of like, where is the warming occurring? And you can see in the United States, which is warming at about the same rate as the whole globe on average, there's more warming, i.e., a lot more warming out west. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of warming going on out here. That might be part of our problem, but out here in the west, we're getting hammered. And that is the reason, a recent paper published with co-authors from University of Arizona, Tom Swetnam, this is the reason why we're getting record wildfire out here. It's not because the forests aren't being treated the right way. It's because it's getting warmer and drier. Okay, so what's ahead? I'm going to show you quickly the best estimates using the most state-of-the-art climate models. These have just been released to the public and will be the basis of this UN climate report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, when it is released in February in Paris. I'm going to look at mid-century, and we're going to look at century end. Keep in mind, though, that unless we act soon to cut off these emissions, the warming will continue after the end of this century. What I'm going to show you then is just like literally the tip of the iceberg. Okay, this is by mid-century, so this is an average of 10 years in the middle of the century, and you can just see that we expect to get up to 4 degrees warming on average over 18 model simulation, different models simulations in the warmest part of the United States. Bear in mind, this is the average. That means there are some models that's saying the warming will be dramatically more. There's some models saying it's going to be less, but we've already warmed 2 degrees. So do you think it's going to be less? You got to be someone who really likes slot machines. Okay. By the end of the century, this stuff isn't totally linear. In other words, it's not going to be the same amount per year. But in this case, we expect to get about double what we'd have by mid-century. And this is business as usual. This is assuming we don't do anything. We're going to get up to 7 or 8 degrees warming in the heartland of the western United States. We get less along the coasts. Remember why? Because the oceans warm up less, and they act to ameliorate the temperature rise along our coasts. And keep in mind that even though our maps here are for the United States, it's going to be quite toasty down in Mexico, too. As well as up in Canada. One of the new things that we've discovered using these better models is that in contrast to 10 years ago when we thought the winters would warm up most, we now think it'll be we'll have more warming in summer, which is unfortunately when we need it the least, right? So we're thinking even more warming in summer. So think lots of warming in the west, more in the summer. In terms of precipitation, we see another phenomena that we didn't see in the more crude models of yore, and that is we anticipate in the United States, more models than not are showing a drying out of the Southwest, less rainfall. And when you factor in those much warmer temperatures, you're gonna get a very unpleasant situation, which I'll show you in a minute. There will be parts of the United States, however, that probably will get more rainfall. So there'll be winners and losers, relatively speaking, although everyone warming up by 7, 8 degrees, there probably is not really a winner. but there'll be bigger losers, let's put it that way, and we're sitting right in the middle of it here. Droughts and floods, we all think in the science community, will be more likely. So on top of these average dry conditions, it's more likely we're going to get droughts, and that they might last longer in the future than they did in the past. We know naturally we can get droughts as long as 40 years. Our colleagues in the tree ring lab here at the University of Arizona, the best, longest standing tree ring lab in the world, they've shown us that droughts of 40 years can happen. What if we get those kinds of droughts superimposed on this globally warmed Earth? Life as we know it in the Southwest probably cannot function. So we have to change our ways, and we have to stop probably these big changes from occurring. It's changes in precipitation, increase in drought. These things are very real, and they're already happening, and that the scientific community is almost, who studies climate, is almost unanimous in saying that humans are causing at least a large part of this, if not almost all of it. If it wasn't for humans, we wouldn't be warming, for example. And that more climate change is a sure bet. How much more climate change? Well, that depends on what we want to do. We can put a lot of greenhouse gas pollution in the atmosphere and really cook this earth like it's never been cooked before. Or we can just put a little more in and maybe save some of these bigger changes, the sea level rise and drying out of the West, keep it from happening. The other thing I really want you to notice on this, because we're going to come back to this, it's very significant. This is where scientists, I'd say, are getting blown away right now. It's 2005, and we're probably going to see more of this in the next few years. It's already 4 degrees warmer than just less than 50 years ago. 4 degrees. Remember that number. It's not. This is exactly the kind of pattern that was expected. You can see South America here, Africa, North America, Eurasia. We're getting more warming over land, and we're getting the most warming at high latitudes. Again, when I was in grad school 25 years ago, this is what scientists were saying was going to happen. It is now what is happening. And when people say that the Earth is going to warm up by X degrees, you all will know that if you live on land, like most people, you're going to warm up more than X degrees. And if you live at higher latitudes, you're going to warm up at a lot more than X degrees.
That was Dr. Jonathan Overbeck, lead climate scientist at the University of Arizona, speaking on October 24, 2006. You can download his full speech from the U of A website or from www.ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
The pine beetle is threatening one of the world's great forests in western Canada. Are we making it worse by logging the dead trees? That's coming up.
Now that the pine forests of British Columbia, one of the great swaths of trees of the world, are dead and dying due to the pine bark beetle, should we cut them down or should we leave them standing? That's the big question as far as climate change is concerned. Dr. Brian Fredin of the University of Northern British Columbia has explained the phenomenon to Brian Coxford of BCTV.
The carbon that's in these trees, which is accumulated now over a period of 60 to 80 years probably, is after mountain pine beetle is going to start to come off now as carbon dioxide gas, which is our primary greenhouse gas.
We already know the pine beetle is a beneficiary of climate change because our weather is no longer cold enough to kill it off. We also know it's become a kind of environmental plague. It will kill 80% of BC's pine forest. It's increased the forest fire risk. It's changing water levels as trees die. And now the pine beetle is likely helping accelerate climate change.
Here is the story. Up until now, we have assumed that cutting down the dead pine forests for lumber would sequester the carbon into the trees of boards and buildings and furniture and other uses. That is much better than letting the forest burn, we think, and releasing vast amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere. Or is it? Writers like Ben Metcalf and now scientists like Dr. Fredin are questioning whether clear-cutting the dead pine really helps save the planet from more climate change or adds to the carbon load. For one thing, this madcap cutting process leaves tons and tons of wood waste on the forest floor. That is true of all clear-cutting.
That waste decomposes into tons of greenhouse gases, perhaps more than was saved by cutting the wood. We don't know for sure. That is why scientists from this northern university have established giant towers over clear cuts, including pine harvesting, to actually measure the amount of CO2 rising up into the air. They are studying the atmosphere above the forest near Prince George, right in the middle of the pine beetle plague. So far, their results suggest that we continue to add more CO2 through the forest process. But more serious, Dr. Fredin suggests, is the fact that lodgepole pines, which are the most plentiful tree in the interior of British Columbia, are great at sucking up CO2 from the atmosphere. Now that this powerful engine is gone, more CO2 will go up there. Let's go back to this excellent news report by BCTV, the global network station in Vancouver, from July 31, 2007, starting with the voice of Dr. Brian Fredin.
They're potentially going to contribute to global warming because of this pulse of release of CO2 coming from these dying and decaying forests.
Also part of the study is the possible effects on global warming created by the accelerated logging of pine beetle kill wood. The harvest in four key areas is up 78% to capture the economic value from infested timber before it has no value at all. In the harvesting process, the tree also releases carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
We found that clear cuts, in a net clear cut sense, they're contributing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere for up to 10 years after you harvest. So that's a continual release of carbon until they start taking up carbon dioxide after 10 years.
The UNBC study has more significance with the knowledge that healthy, mature lodgepole pine trees absorb more carbon dioxide than other harvested trees. The pine occupies up to 30% of our timber harvest land, and to date, the pine beetle has killed an area of pine forest three times the size of Vancouver Island.
Now, the area Brian just referred to, that's three times the size of Vancouver Island, amounts to a staggering 9.2 million hectares of BC forest. The pine beetle has a lot of food to go through. Lodgepole pine covers 50% of the interior of BC and 30% of the province as a whole. Last year alone, the pine beetle killed some 90 million cubic meters of timber. It sounds like a lot, but believe it or not, that's actually an improvement over previous years. Last year, the attack area grew by just 500,000 hectares. In 2005, it grew by 1.7 million hectares, and the year before that, it grew by nearly 3 million hectares. But don't think that means this problem is solved. The slower increase in the attack area is simply because the beetle is running out of food. Chris, that's NewsHour Insight for tonight.
So Dr. Ferdin, the UNBC professor of ecosystem science, suggests that the pine bark beetle has changed the forest from a natural sink for carbon dioxide into a new source of this dangerous greenhouse gas. And it all started because winters in the north are now too warm, under climate change, to kill off the insect predators. Climate change breeds more climate change, and yet another positive feedback effect just being discovered. Forest industry executives argue that the clear cuts will be replanted, and those new trees will begin to accumulate significant amounts of carbon dioxide out of the air as they grow, 10 years or more from now. First of all, that assumes that the replanting will work, given the weird weather predicted under climate change. It may turn out the new species will not thrive as the old, under drought or heat. Some area may even turn into grasslands, despite replanting the trees. But the real problem is that during that 10-year gap, these dead forests fail to recapture carbon dioxide. Instead, they release CO2 that they had gathered. Warmer winters and the pine bark beetle have robbed the earth of a giant carbon vacuum cleaner, the 10 million hectares of pine forests in one of the largest remaining stands on the planet. The great boreal forests of Canada may be infected next. In a statement quoted in the Vancouver Sun, Fredin said, quote, "Clear cutting can release enormous amounts of carbon to the atmosphere for 10 years or more after harvesting," end quote. That is news the government and the logging industry doesn't want to hear. The Campbell government has been ramping up to claim logging and reforestation in British Columbia as green technologies, possibly even for carbon credits in a world trading program. But if actual scientific tests show clear-cutting releases lots of carbon, the whole scheme means clear-cut logging isn't climate-friendly at all. No big surprise there. Deforestation is blamed for about a quarter of the new greenhouse gases poisoning the atmosphere around the world. And, according to scientists like NASA's James Hansen, this particular 10 years is the most important period in history when it comes to the future direction of the climate. Humans have tripped up a sensitive mechanism that can tip the climate from ice to tropical heat, and we have only another 10 years or so to clamp down on our carbon emissions from all sources before we tip irrevocably into a new and very damaged climate. Even if new forests can grow to replace the massive pine forests of British Columbia, in a decade or two, that will be too late to stop extreme temperature rise, they think, and other positive feedback loops. There isn't a winning game plan here, I'm sorry to say, but if the next 10 years are as critical as top experts claim, and if clear-cutting the dead pine actually speeds up release of CO2, then the world might be better off letting the carbon stay in the dead pine trees while we move into a crash program to replace fossil fuels with renewables and energy conservation. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Coming up next week, we hope, an interview with Greg Green. He's the award-winning director of the film End of Suburbia. Actually, the full title was The End of Suburbia, Oil Depletion, and the Collapse of the American Dream. It all hasn't happened yet, but by God, we're working on it. Cities keep on spreading out as though gas wasn't $4 or $5 a gallon and headed towards $10 a gallon. Every family in China is either driving a car, saving up to buy a car, or dreaming of buying a car, as though the core of the world was really made out of an oily candy taffy we can just keep pulling out of the ground without end. Amen. Now Greg has come out with a new film. Naturally, it's called Escape from Suburbia, and, I'm told, may actually show a few ways to get out of the coming mess. Here is the audio from a new film trailer, which doesn't do much justice to the collage of images Greg uses, using the past to show the future, somehow skipping through the banality of right now. Did I mention Green's new film is coming to Vancouver August 17th?
We have a serious problem. America is addicted to oil.
If you ask the question, do we have a plan for what we're going to do when we reach peak oil? The answer is certainly no.
Breakthroughs are new technologies.
It almost seems like fiction. This is like Never Never Land.
Vice President Dick Cheney articulated it pretty clearly when he said the American way of life was non-negotiable. The trouble with that statement is that if you don't want to negotiate your way of life, you automatically get a new negotiating partner named reality.
You've got to have personal empowerment, you've got to have pricing changes, you've got to have policy changes, you've got to have technology changes.
Powering down, consuming less, getting out of debt.
Grow food on your balcony, on your roof.
These are all things that you and you alone are responsible for figuring out. Don't expect Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy to come do it for you.
It's just a part of...
Have you ever heard that on the news? Oh, me neither.
This time round, Green and producer Dara Rowland look at people trying to live more responsible lives, trying to figure out how to live outside suburbia, without suburbia. They tell us tomorrow is not going to be one big extended version of today. It just can't be, as surely as fossil fuels run out or get banned, whichever comes first. Experts in Canada have already calmly announced that our natural gas reserves will run out in a mere 10 years. Canada, the giant natural gas supplier. Yet everyone heats with it, and many cook with it. Our power plants burn natural gas with no thought of alternatives. That's why new proposals for liquid natural gas shipping terminals are popping up like mushrooms after a rain. They want to build one on Texada Island now, getting closer to the big markets and the big cities. No doubt, as the price goes through the roof, we'll all demand these LNG ship terminals get fast-tracked, no matter how risky they are. We'll beg for dangerous cargoes to be shipped through sensitive and stormy inland channels on the coast, or freeze in the dark, apparently. Nobody seems to have heard that BC has enough wind power, especially up north, to satisfy all our needs, and exports to boot. and tidal power doesn't exist for us here on the ocean. We demand the future be made strictly out of the past. Even though these foreign gas sources will run out too, and even though most of the gas will come from Russia, which has just claimed the Canadian Arctic as its own, no problems there. Oil is much worse. American supplies are already far past peak, deep into depletion. The last big pools are in the hands of people who hate America and its way of life, and despite all the billions in the world, the big oil companies have been unable to find any new giant oil fields. We'll just boil down the whole of northern Alberta for the tar and the sand, and then we'll tear down the Rocky Mountains for a few drops of oil from the shale, because we just can't change, damn it. Dick Cheney said so. Tune in to the other side of this reality, August 17th at 7:30 p.m., when Escape from Suburbia premieres in Vancouver on August the 17th at the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, 154 East 10th Avenue. Basically, that's 10th and Main, August 17th, for Greg Green's new film, Escape from Suburbia. And tune in next week to Radio EcoShock for a promised interview with director Greg Green, or My Name's Not Alex Smith. Let's go out with a reggae offering by Sylvanus called Save the Earth. Radio EcoShock is heard every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. You can listen via the internet at www.cooperadio.org. That's coopradio.org. Get us by satellite on Star Choice Channel 845. Or download each show for your computer or iPod from our website at www.ecoshock.org. EcoShock is also heard on other nonprofit community and college radio stations. Ask your local station to carry our program. And tell your email friends about our show. Link your site to ours. We have a planet to save together. Here's Sylvanus with Save the Earth.